Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 484, another interview with Daniel Hopsicker. This is the third consecutive interview we've done with Daniel. This has been recorded on November 7th of the year 2004, and once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to present Daniel Hopsicker, the author of, among other titles, Welcome to Terrorland, Muhammad Atta and the 9/11 Cover-Up in Florida. Daniel, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Hi, Dave.
Well, you conducted a remarkable and a very heroic and no doubt pretty scary investigation down there in Florida of the hijackers, the September 11th hijackers that had been based in Florida to a certain extent, that had, quote, trained, unquote, in Florida. As we've seen in the past, a lot of them already had a lot of training. And you came across some networks which certainly appear to have been protected, were involved in illegal activity, and to a certain extent are ongoing. And what I'd like to do is to explore some of those networks and some of the various tributaries that go into and out of them a little bit further. For the benefit of listeners who have not heard our previous interviews, Daniel, or who have not read your wonderful book, and we'll give information about that in your website later on in the program, if you could review for us how the September 11th hijackers relate to a guy named Wally Hilliard and just maybe briefly, Rudy Deckers and Arne Krutoff, again, by way of review for newer listeners.
Well, Wally Hilliard owned the flight school that both of the terrorists who piloted the planes that hit the World Trade Center came to fly at. It was run by a guy named Rudy Deckers, a Dutch national who moved in a year earlier and was soon training more than 1,000 foreign nationals a year.
Arabs and Germans, largely, and we'll touch on that a little later. Wally Hilliard, a man with, as I like to say, more connections than a switchboard. He was involved in a number of really interesting things. Last week we touched on his connections to the good Reverend Falwell, that's Jerry Falwell, of the Christian Coalition, and some of the interesting activities they were involved in together. One of the many fascinating personages whom you talk about is a guy named Mark Shubin. Tell us about Mark Shubin, who he was, and how does he relate to Wally Hilliard?
Isn't he fascinating? I first heard about Mark Shubin from several Wally Hilliard employees, and the story I got from one was that Wally Hilliard was an ex-KGB agent.
You mean Mark Shubin?
Mark Shubin, right.
Yeah.
Mark Shubin. See, Mark Shubin and Wally Hilliard are partnered in four or five extraordinarily fast, expensive aircraft. And some of their planes that they own jointly carry strange designations and numbers. They use the number UN. They use the number 11. UN 11 is one of their planes.
Now, wasn't Mr. Khan, P.J. Khan, one of the pilots for one of those aircraft?
PJ was Wally's personal pilot. Shubin is an aviation associate of his, apparently. They own Gulfstreams together.
Mm-hmm.
And Shubin, okay, so I go, well, who was Mark Shubin?
Right.
And the first story I heard was that he was an ex-KGB colonel. And the second story I heard was that, yeah, that was true, but then he became a general in the Jamaican military. And he's tied to the Russian mob, and he used to fly Premier Putin around.
Is that all?
So imagine how intimidated I was when I went to the Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport for a conspiracy writer like myself is Disneyland.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I walked into the hangar and I met Mr. Shubin, who was a pleasant person and extraordinarily intelligent. And I heard a glimmer of who he really is, of who, and we're interested in him because he is in business with the man who, whose flight school served as a magnet for unknown reasons for Hamburg cadre principals.
Mm-hmm.
The story goes like this. Shubin was a Russian national whose father was a KGB colonel spying for the U.S., was caught in about 59 or 60, and then was ransomed out of Russia, along with his whole family, in the spy trade that brought Francis Gary Powers, the downed U-2 pilot, back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So young Mark Shubin grew up in the U.S., but he, of course, spoke Russian, and he became a CIA pilot. And then he became a CIA pilot who flew over flights of Russia, probably because of his Russian language expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Went on to a later career that did indeed involve flying Premier Putin around. That apparently involves having ties with the Russian mob. Among numerous organizations, the Israeli Defense Forces. And apparently he was a general in the Jamaican military for whatever reason. But he was an extraordinarily interesting person, and he looked just like a spy master to me.
Well, certainly, yeah, the number of different nationalities in whose uniformed or otherwise services he had served is really sort of like a walking United Nations. Tell us about Mark Shubin and Wally Hilliard and how they relate. And we'll move on, because this is just the tip of a fascinating iceberg. And this by the way, is by way of setting some of the deep political connections that these fascinating networks are part of, and apparently whose bidding they do to a certain extent. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know what you want to hear about Hilliard and Shubin, besides the fact that they're in business together.
Mm-hmm.
Shubin is also in business, or was in business, partnered in an airline with a man named Kenneth Good, who I discovered was the reason Neil Bush became famous.
Tell us about Kenneth Good, Neil Bush, and
Mark Shubin's partner, Kenneth Good, helped himself to several hundred million dollars of public funds through the Silverado savings and loan debacle in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
which apparently was going to be exposed by Time Magazine just before the 88 election, before they received a phone call and never went ahead with the story.
So they were told basically that this would not be a good idea.
Yeah.
It is most disturbing. By the way, for the benefit of veteran listeners, we talked about the Silverado savings and loan scandal, the connections to Neil Bush, in not only the miscellaneous series about the SNL scandal, but also a number of other broadcasts as well. And both, well, Pete Bruton in particular wrote a wonderful book linking the looting of the savings and loans to not only organized crime, but also to some of the overlapping elements that were involved with the Iran-Contra support network. And those are elements that overlap the story of Mohammed Atta and company in Florida to a considerable extent, too. Can you tell us briefly what happened to the Silverado savings and loan?
It went bust at the cost to American taxpayers of, I think, more than $1 billion.
And how did George Bush, the elder's baby boy, Neil, relate to that?
He interceded with the Silverado board to get this guy, to get Mark Shubin's partner money.
And this, again, we should note, is altogether illegal.
How does the guy that owns the flight school that terrorists come to end up having connections with guys, in the KGB and involved in major American fraud?
And just about everything. Shubin really is a fascinating character. But again, for the benefit of listeners, Wally Hilliard was sort of the godfather of the flight schools in which many of the hijackers appear to have trained, not just Marwan al-Shahi and Atta, but a few of the others as well. And Wally Hilliard's business partner, Mark Shubin, in a number of different aircraft, is a fellow with more connections than a switchboard. Israeli Defense Forces, KGB, CIA, a general in the Jamaican Army, Russian mob, flying Mr. Putin around, and some of their air ventures.
And exactly the point is that this is the milieu in which Mohammed Atta walked around.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He didn't slip through America unnoticed,
right,
as the official story would have us believe, did he? I mean, he's walking around like a super spy, with elite jet set spook friends.
It looks too like it. In our last interview, we mentioned Sybil Edmonds, who is a whistleblower, a woman who's done some translating for the FBI, and came across some of these networks. I would just suggest in passing that one wants to avoid oversimplifying some of this, because these appear to be networks that, to one extent or another, overlap criminal activity. They also have some national security connections and also political connections. But I would avoid being just for the benefit of listeners oversimplifying some of this. But it is a fascinating tale.
Well, here's what's interesting about it. I mean, she saw it from a completely different angle than I did.
Mm-hmm.
And her terminology, you know, led me to shake my head and go, "Yeah, that's it. That's kind of it." You know, she called it quasi-official.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
A good word would be parapolitical. You know, these are parapolitical and also in some ways paramilitary networks. They're not exactly political and not exactly military, but they function in some ways as parallel to both of those.
And of course, I'm sticking to facts on the ground and interviewing,
sure,
you know, people door to door. But one of the most telling comments in hindsight that I heard was from a man who I believe had something to do with running the Venice airport for the U.S. military before September 11th,
mm-hmm,
and who was remorseful at what the operation had resulted in, and confided in me that he had made inquiries about Rudy Deckers and, mm-hmm, Wally Hilliard. And he had heard that about Mr. Deckers, he should not ask any questions, that Deckers was, and here's the phrase I remember, because it struck me as odd, I don't hear stuff like this every day, that Deckers was bigger than national, he's transnational.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I haven't a clue what that means, except what we see here is people from a number of different countries operating in fluid motion.
That's why I made the point that I did, is a lot of people, and this is not to find fault with them, but a lot of people might read your book and say, oh, the CIA did September 11th. That, I think, is a gross oversimplification, but nonetheless, there certainly appears to be an intelligence and, to a certain extent, CIA link to some of these operations, but I would compare this more with a sewer, a vast open sewer that's running, and all kinds of things move through the sewer.
Well,
it doesn't mean that it's Department of Public Works that's doing it, you know?
Yeah.
So that would be maybe one sort of crude metaphor. But let's explore some of these names, because, again, to give people a feeling for what was going on in Florida, the environment, or as I like to use my favorite term, milieu, through which the hijackers were able to not only enter the United States but gain a fair amount of protection from officialdom basically do their deeds, so to speak. We've talked about Ken Good, Mark Shubin's partner, Mark Shubin's relation to hijacker, trainer, godfather Wally Hilliard. Can you tell us a little more about the Skybus and Express One? Because there's this whole filigree of aviation companies or pseudo-aviation companies that runs throughout your tale.
Right, and it all runs back to the 70s, strangely enough. Back in the mid-70s, those of us who remember it well, there was a public revulsion after Watergate against the excesses of the CIA. And as a result of that, Congress passed measures requiring the CIA to divest itself of its airlines. The CIA at that point ran the biggest airline in the world. And rather than do that, what they did was establish these companies that looked private, but really weren't.
And these are some of the elements. One of the things, time permitting, that I'd like to touch on later is that some of these networks appear to be some of the networks that we saw in connection with the Iran-Contra affair so many years ago, and the existence of which, or the investigation of which, was dismissed by too many people as, quote, conspiracy theory, unquote. The networks continued, and now
these are those people.
Yep.
These are those people, and the alternate explanation for the CIA's role in 9/11. I do not pretend to be offering, you know, an explanation at this point. But if I was to offer an alternate one to the CIA, knew it, did it for George, it would point to Iran-Contra and to show that what spies do has very little to do with looking over the shoulder of people from other countries. It involves commerce.
Mm-hmm.
Commerce. It's a business like any other, isn't it?
It is indeed, and I would suggest, you know, hearkening back to some of the programs that I've done that listeners might remember, that some of these commercial relationships actually take priority over anything that we would consider to be patriotism or civic responsibility.
That's exactly what Sybil Edmonds is saying.
That it really is sort of a fifth column. It is within this country, and language, I think, it becomes a limitation in some ways in understanding this. That's why I use the term fifth column, but it is within this country. It is within this country's intelligence services in part, and inside of what we call the government, and yet it has no allegiance to or loyalty to this country or its government or anything that the average American would represent as the U.S. of A. It is rather, as your informant said, transnational, and that I think would be a really good way to sum it up.
That explains why we haven't been told the truth about what happened. When I think I brought the point out last week that Mohammed Atta in 1995 lent $25,000 to a Turkish acquaintance in Hamburg who needed the money to start a bakery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mohammed Atta was a penniless graduate student in 1995, unless he wasn't.
Well, penniless belongs in quotes.
If he's got enough money to be, you know, rolling off hundreds, you know, to give $25,000 to a Turkish guy and not even take a note back on it, which he didn't, that's spare change to him at that point.
He had a lot of money, and one of the things that you point out is that not only Atta, but people like Rudy Dekkers and others have these huge bankrolls. And
They're rolling in money.
Not just money, but cash, large amounts of cash.
No visible means of support. No businesses making a profit, and yet $300,000 worth of cars, $500,000 yacht, a $2 million house. You know, this is. Nobody ever told me where you had to go to apply for jobs like this.
It was like that old famous pop song, nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try, if you know where to go. One of the places that people might want to go to try that, I don't know if the gentleman's still alive or in business, we've spoken about Rudy Dekkers, but there was the other of the Magic Dutch Boys. Before we get into some of the interesting business connections of Arne Krutoff, if you could tell us how he also relates to the hijacker milieu.
Well, This was visible as soon as I got to Venice, what I'm about to tell you. This was visible the week after September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
The government's story is that two separate Dutch nationals, having nothing to do with each other, each purchased one of the two flight schools at the Venice, Florida airport within a year before the terrorists began to arrive, is just a coincidence. It's absurd on its face. When I ran that by a famous Southern lawman whose acquaintance I was lucky enough to have made in the course of researching Barry and the Boys, he drawled, and as we thought, he drawled, that's one damn Dutch boy, too many.
One is a happenstance. Two would appear to be more than coincidence.
Do you know what he said?
What's that?
He said, it's untidy.
Untidy would apply to a lot of what was taking place there. Arne Krutoff, again, the other of the Magic Dutch Boys. How does he relate to the hijacker milieu?
Well, he trained. He had hijackers rotating through. See, you know, it wasn't like they trained one or two hijackers or one or two Arabs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
A small amount of schools. There were several places it went on. Clearly not everywhere. But there were a little circle, swath of flight schools in Southwest Florida, which experienced, they went from having virtually no Arab flight students in 98 and 99 to having maybe 1,500 in 2000 and maybe 2,000 in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly is a large increase.
You can't overlook that. I mean, that's the CIA, no matter how incompetent, couldn't overlook that. I happen to have heard, and I have no idea whether it's true, that the way I look at it, covert intelligence, government-sponsored covert intelligence is just that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it comes from the CIA or the DIA or the NSA or any of the other half dozen agencies, you know, whose acronyms I don't even know, doesn't so much matter, does it, ultimately, as you know, that it's government-sponsored.
Mm-hmm.
So the particular agency that I have heard bandied about that's involved here in Venice, and in Naples, Florida, and up in Boston, and in San Diego is the FBI. And
you mean as an alleged sponsoring element here?
Oh yeah.
Because obviously one of the things you point out in your book is that the FBI, as they were coming across these protected networks, was unable to do anything about it, and then ultimately wound up kicking over the traces so that nobody else could do anything about it.
Well, can I describe the situation to you?
Sure.
It's like this, all right? I met a man who knew Barry Seal back from 1963 on.
Let me interrupt real quick, Daniel. Barry Seal was a longtime drug trafficker, CIA operative with connections to the Iran-Contra milieu, alleged by some to have been a getaway pilot for some of the assassins in the JFK assassination, and the focal point of Daniel's first book, Barry and the Boys. Go ahead, Daniel.
Anyway, this guy later became a confidant of Seal's, and so close that he was the executor of Seal's estate when he died. So Seal trusted him, and he was military intelligence. And back in the 1964, his job was to fly into the Golden Triangle in Laos, over in Southeast Asia,
mm-hmm.
to find out what Barry Seal was doing. And he told me that as best he could figure it out later, one half of us was investigating the other half, but we all work for the same people.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that in some ways, I think, encompasses the dilemma in terms of the average person conceptualizing what's going on here.
Sure,
it's a hell of a lot more complicated and less unequivocal than people think.
Well, I think there have been a half dozen heroic FBI agents, haven't there? That have, totally destroyed their careers over 9/11? Just by coming forward?
A bunch, and if you count the late heroic John O'Neill, who was trying to nail some of the Saudi connections before this, he went down and he got buried in one of the towers on September 11th.
Once again, you find that it's the grunts on the ground that tend to be honest,
Mm-hmm.
The local cops, the FBI agents that aren't getting a piece of this or that.
It is interesting how a lot of this goes from bottom up. In other words, it's the people that are lower down who seem to comprise an awful lot of the really loyal spear carriers, and then a lot of this gets compromised higher up. Speaking of which, the other Dutch boy, so to speak, Arne Krutoff, who was running one of these strange, quote, flight schools, unquote, really a cover. Tell us a little bit about his operation and his partner, Glenn Goodman.
Well, I'll tell you something about Arne Krutoff that's not in the book, and then I'll tell you about Glenn Goodman.
Sure.
Several of the business owners at the Venice Airport were sources of mine in the book, because they saw activity that was unexplainable by conventional means going on right in front of them day in and day out.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these people told me that in a conversation with Arne Krutoff, Krutoff had told him that he had trained, done military training in the U.S. at a base in southeast Missouri. Well, this source of mine at the airport is from southeast Missouri, and he looked at me when he told me this story, and he says, there aren't any bases in southeast Missouri.
Well, none that he knows of.
Oh, right, exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
So the point is that Arne Krutoff, like so many of the people, had information not generally available, not just information, but other things as well, not generally available to the average man or woman on or off the street.
Right. So while Rudy Dekker's financial backer is the furtive Wally Hilliard, Arne Krutoff's backer is the son of the, biggest Budweiser distributor in the country in Tampa. And he's said to look a little like Howard Hughes, as if there wasn't enough color in this story. And he's involved in interesting endeavors as other endeavors as well. For example, he was involved in donating a DC-3 several years ago to a Florida military museum that may or may not exist.
It may or may not exist.
In real life.
Well, that would certainly suggest, once again...
The DC-3 exists.
Yeah, okay. So it would appear that DC-3 might be part of what you call a Venice flying circus.
Yes, very definitely. I mean, it was driven home to me The first time I went to the Charlotte County Airport, interestingly enough, which is 20 minutes south of here, these two airports were almost interchangeable.
Now, the Charlotte Airport, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the one that we spoke about last week where the Sheriff's Department had 23 helicopters stolen from them?
Well, you know, somebody there told me they hadn't actually been stolen. They had just been released on their own recognizance.
Okay, well, you know, let's just say that the Charlotte Airport, that was the same airport where the Sheriff's helicopters took off with a remarkable degree of regularity. And just headed for point or points unknown, right?
Well, so it's a tiny rural airport, and the first thing you notice when you drive in is this silver DC-4 tied down, which is painted like an airborne ark.
That's as a Noah's Ark.
Right. Yeah. Rhinos and hippos all climbing, you know, the cockpit. And the plane belonged to Frank Moss until it was impounded for alleged drug running 2 years ago. And strangely enough, it's not even the first plane of his that's been confiscated there. He had a plane confiscated in 86, and they found Oliver North's seat cushion. that was how they found out that North and Owens were writing about this guy, Frank Moss, that North knew that Moss was bringing drugs back in planes he was flying weapons down to.
Part of this Iran-Contra drug traffic that we've been speaking about.
And another guy that's right there at the airport. Okay, now here's the story.
Danny, by the way, we're almost out of time on this side, so we may have to pick up the rest of the story on the other one. But
you know what? I'll tell you a story on the other side that isn't in the book, but that's truly amazing.
Sure. Go ahead, though. We still have a couple of minutes. Now, by way of tying some of this together, but this is Glenn Goodman, who is the partner of Arne Krutoff.
Right,
but
he was flying out of the Charlotte airport.
We're
more or less free-associating here, so I'm just telling you a story now about another guy. I mean, you're talking Iran-Contra operatives, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mohammed Atta bumped into these guys every day.
Right.
Okay? Frank Moss is there, and the other guy that's there is Dietrich Reinhardt.
Dietrich Reinhardt, Mrs. Reinhardt's baby boy, Dietrich.
Well, you know, also an Iran-Contra operative and owner of an airline whose planes were confiscated by federal prosecutors in Mena, Arkansas in 1990, and after being accused, the airline was accused of bringing billions, not millions, billions of dollars worth of cocaine into this country.
Fascinating.
I don't think Dietrich went to jail over that.
A lot of people seem to have
But follow me through here, because I'm going to tie it all together in one line. Dietrich Reinhardt is in business at the airport with a man named Jamie Hill. Jamie Hill runs an operation through which it is suspected those 23 helicopters passed. So it all ties together. And Dietrich Reinhardt is in business with Rudy Deckers.
And we will talk about these people, the German connections, the links running to Iran-Contra. And for people who might have just tuned in, this is the milieu through which Atta and company appear to have infiltrated the United States prior to September 11th. Daniel, you have a number of materials available. Give us your website, 800 number, where people can pick up Welcome to Terrorland and the other materials you have available.
Well, we do the Mad Cow Morning News on the web at madcowprod.com. And, you know, the stuff to keep afloat, we sell books and tapes to my two books, 5-6 tapes. We've got a new episode of Conspiracy Tonight going up Tuesday with more footage with Muhammad Atta's American girlfriend and a piece about the election. I guess the 800 number's on the website, but I'll give it to you anyway. It's 800-556-2012.
And we'll repeat that on the other side of the program. Remember, holiday season is coming up. People might want to think about Welcome to Terrorland and Daniel Hopsicker's other materials as holiday gifts. Also, remember, www.spitfirelist.com. Descriptions of the programs and lists of all the other material available from Spitfire. www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. The WFMU website with streaming real audio of the For the Record shows. Older shows available for download only on a longer URL. Link to both that and the For the Record section of the Spitfire website as well. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 484, another interview with Daniel Hopsicker, being recorded on November 7th of the year 2004. For Daniel Hopsicker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.